Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on making Mrs. Carey's concert. We have three speakers. They're well known by name or by their role in the documentary. Bob Connolly, a filmmaker and co-director of Mrs. Carey's concert. He is also an author and, of course, the filmmaker of Rats in the Ranks, a famous documentary. And Mrs. Carey's concert, I should point out, was the second highest grossing documentary in Australian film. So we're going to lead off with Bob Connolly. Then we go to Sophie Raymon. Sophie Raymon is a singer-songwriter and animator. She worked on Harvey Crumpet, which was a famous animation, and is here in her capacity as the co-director of Mrs. Carey's concert. And Karen Carey, who also doubles as Mrs. Carey, which is a rather old-fashioned term these days. I like these old-fashioned terminology. And of course, Karen Carey is music director at MLC School in Sydney. So we'll just run in order. We'll start with Bob, we'll go to Sophie, we'll go to Karen. They'll each speak for about 15 minutes each, then we'll have some questions and discussion and finish up probably a little bit before 7 o'clock. So, Bob Connolly, many thanks for coming.
Thank you. I'm going first because I do all the dry stuff, and then it'll get progressively more interesting. Okay, so question, what do Mrs. Carey and the schoolgirl stars of Mrs. Carey's concert have in common with a Canadian Inuit who died nearly a century ago? Tick, 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 no. The Inuit's name was Nanook, and he too was the subject of a feature documentary, the first ever made. It was called Nanook of the North. The American oil prospector Robert Flaherty began filming Nanook in exactly 100 years ago, this year, on location in the remote wilds of the Canadian Arctic. I go on all the time about how hard it is to make documentaries, but I can tell you, compared to Flaherty, we had it easy out at MLC Burwood. After a year of cold and privation, Flaherty returned to New York and began editing his 70,000 feet of rushes. Now, movie film was highly inflammable in those days, and one day Flaherty carelessly dropped his cigarette in his rushes, and the whole lot went up in smoke. He was actually quite badly burnt. And he barely escaped with his life, which I only just discovered a couple of days ago. Undeterred, he went back and shot the whole thing again. This time in the editing room, he watched where he put his cigarettes. And he finished the film, and it was a smash hit in cinemas across the United States and Europe. Flaherty went off to Samoa next and made a film about life in paradise called Moana. Reviewing it in the New York Times, the Scotsman John Grierson coined the term documentary for the first time, defining it as, quote, the creative treatment of actuality. But was it actuality? Nanook and Moana certainly portrayed real people in real locations, but because of the difficulties and restrictions back then imposed by primitive camera equipment in outside locations, most of what happens was acted out for the camera, staged. True observational documentary had to wait until the late 1950s and 60s to come into its own, finally made possible by the development of lightweight, handheld 16mm cameras, high-speed film stocks and crystal sync portable synchronous tape recorders. That's a mouthful. A pioneer example of this was Primary, made in 1959, an inside look at the lead-up to the 1960 presidential campaign. In a pivotal moment, Democratic candidate John F. Kennedy takes a hurried backstage route to a stage somewhere in America with the filmmaker and his sound recordist hurrying with him, stopping where Kennedy stops, eavesdropping on his whispered conversations, emerging on stage with the candidate and swinging round to show the rapturous applause of the audience. Sounds straightforward enough today, but in 1960 that was revolutionary. I had primary in mind when using the same following shot in my New Guinea film Joe Lay's Neighbours, made with Robin Anderson, and there's a similar backstage shot at the Sydney Opera House in Mrs. Carey's concert, which, like all observational films today, draws direct inspiration from a long line of pioneers going right back to Flaherty. But observational films aren't the only documentaries. Think of The Sorrow and the Pity, Bowling for Columbine, The Thin Blue Line, and Inconvenient Truth. All these essay films sit within Grierson's broad definition, a creative treatment of actuality, but they're vastly different in style and content to observational films. Essay filmmakers construct their vision of reality. Observational filmmakers observe it. I'll tell you why I love making observational films, why for the past 30-odd years that's all I've ever made. In reviewing Rats in the Ranks a few years back, Helen Garner wrote of one scene, a writer would give her right arm to make it up, but it springs from a realm of reality beyond the power of ordinary invention. Garner's not just reaffirming that truth can be stranger than fiction. She's saying that observational documentary offers the same cinematic possibilities as fiction, to enthrall and enlighten, to portray intensely dramatic, intensely emotional experiences and relationships constructed not from the fiction writer's imagination, but from real life. If you doubt this cinematic potential, go find Molly Dineen's Home from the Hill, Murray Lerner's Mao to Mozart, Ira Wall's Best Boy, Steve James's Hoop Dreams. For that matter, think of the fearlessly sassy Irish she in Mrs. Carey's concert, telling Mrs. Carey just before the concert that she'd be rather be somewhere else, thanks very much. Or the extraordinary moment at the concert when the wayward Emily's son overcomes her demons and nails the Brook Violin Concerto. How do you capture scenes beyond the power of ordinary invention? Helen Garner's definition suggests serendipity, and to some extent it does depend on chance. But when I teach documentary, I always quote the golfer who said after holing in one, "Isn't that extraordinary? The more I practice, the luckier I get." In other words, it's about making your own luck through choice of subject, acute analysis, sensitivity, patience, commitment, observational skills, compassion, respect, and perhaps most important of all, an open mind. What counts then is not flights of imagination, but buckets of perspiration, at least in the shooting phase. Editing's a different kettle of fish, as Sophie Raymond will explain. The technical term for the five observational films I've made with my late partner Robin Anderson, and now with Sophie, is, quote, uncontrolled narrative verite, unquote. Essentially, this involves unearthing and documenting a narrative by means of the uncontrolled observation of unfolding natural events and then shaping this material in an editing room into a story, much as a sculptor does a block of marble. Essentially, it's no different to a fiction drama, except that the characters and the story are drawn from real life. Verite, of course, is French for truth. When you set out to make a narrative verite film like Mrs. Carey's concert, you can't make things up like a fiction scriptwriter. You can't invent dramatic developments. Most times you haven't the slightest idea what's going to happen from day to day. So in observational film, your muse is not creativity so much as uncertainty. But in order to embrace uncertainty and all it implies, it helps to have a methodology, a set of rules to work by. My methodology boils down to two words, control and uncontrol. You must control everything that enables you to make the film without compromise, so that paradoxically you can then relinquish that control. What do I mean by control? Well, the first element is time. The average shoot edit production time of a documentary in Australia is 6 months or less. But to make a feature-length narrative verite film like Mrs. Carey's concert, you must be prepared to film for years, if necessary, to maximise the possibility of a narrative not only emerging, but playing itself out over time into some kind of denouement, offering dramatically satisfying closure. And the story has to emerge organically from the successive sequences, just as it does in a fiction drama. There's no voice of God narrator in Mrs. Carey's concept to paper over information gaps. In other words, there are no shortcuts. You have to put in the hard yards. Our shooting time on location is rarely less than 18 months, and the same goes for editing. So Mrs. Carey's concert took 3 years to shoot and edit. Another control element is analysis. When your raw material is unfolding real life, you're constantly analysing what's happening so you know what to shoot and, more importantly, what not to shoot. Shooting without focus over 18 months would be like bushwalking blindfold, a recipe for disaster. We were very disciplined on Mrs. Carey's concert, but even so, we shot 263 hours. That's a lot of material to edit down to 90 minutes. We looked at those rushes 8 hours a day for 33 days, and that was before we started editing. The next control element is often the most problematic, autonomy. You must be able to operate as independently as possible, without costly overheads, without bureaucratic interference. Several hundred people work on the set of a typical fiction drama. In an observation documentary, it's usually two. In this case, Sophie, Raymond and myself. And we do just about everything. Maximising the number of skills you can bring helps you retain control over the process and so avoid compromise. Realise your vision. I have a hard and fast rule. At the end of a film, I must be able to say, that's as good as I can do. I have no excuses. Sounds obvious, but it's probably the exception rather than the rule in Australian documentary. Films cost money, and whoever controls the money typically influences how the film is made, not always to its benefit. I view lots of films nearing completion. Most are not as good as they could be and should be because their makers have been forced to compromise. So, only when you've achieved complete control over the production process can you then take the vital step of relinquishing that control in the field, of launching yourself onto the unexplored river, the chaotic, unpredictable arena of real life, totally led by the unfolding events, never telling anyone what to do or say, never repeating action, doing nothing to interfere with the unfolding situation, just being there, watching, listening, absorbing it all, continually analysing. If you've made the right subject choice and you follow these rules, and if you don't take sides, a story will emerge and gradually unfold, and those serendipitous moments will occur right in front of your camera. Think of the naughty girls who sabotaged Mrs. Carey's computer in her absence. We had no idea that was going to happen, but it was no accident that we were in that classroom. The naughty girls are in a classroom, and Mrs. Carey has got a DVD of Aida, the Grand March from Aida. But she has to go off and have a phone call, and in her absence, a couple of these kids sneak up to the computer and doctor it so that it's impossible to see it clearly.
I'm sorry the image is not the same. This is the actual sequence that we're doing for the Opera House. I'm not going to play the whole lot. I'm going to play you a segment of it. So I want you to actually see what's happening. I want you to imagine there's a huge, big parade. I am so serious. That is your very last chance. You you have to imagine a huge, big parade. Have a look at it and tell me what you can actually capture, how it's done theatrically, and then we'll work out how it's done musically. Okay, let's have a look. I'm a bit not, the image is nothing like what it should be.
Do you want me to try and change the colours?
Do you know how to do that?
Yeah.
Sometimes
it just changes like that.
What did you do?
It like does the negative colours.
Thank you.
No, why doesn't
do
that?
Okay, here we go. Don't talk.
Now, why did those girls feel that they could do that in front of my camera and Sophie's microphone? Sure, Mrs. Carey was out of the room, but we were there. So why did they ignore us and do what would normally get them into trouble? Well, first of all, they didn't ignore us. How could they? We weren't in hiding and we weren't flies on the wall. We were sitting right next to the computer. But because we'd followed the rules that I've listed earlier and were content to observe and never interfere, we'd become part of the furniture. Secondly, by that stage, they trusted us not to take sides, to snitch. And they were right to trust us. I'm honoured to have Karen Carey as a friend, but I would never, for love or money, have ratted on those kids. Mrs. Carey didn't know what they did to her computer until she watched the finished film 2 years later when the kids in question were about to leave school. Not taking sides. That's worth examining more closely because it carries greater implications than simple loyalty to your subjects. Documentary has a long tradition of taking sides. It emerged in the Depression years and came of age during the Cold War. And many never questioned, still don't for that matter, that its primary role was to take sides, to teach or preach. I worked on David Bradbury's Oscar-nominated and anti-Pinochet film, Chile Has to Cuando, and I'm proud of it. The dictator Pinochet was a murdering tyrant. David Bradbury makes films to help set the world right. And there's no doubt which side he's on. Al Gore's the same in An Inconvenient Truth and Michael Moore in Sicko. Ooh. My first film with Robin Anderson was First Contact, about the 1930s penetration of the New Guinea Highlands by Australian gold prospectors. Like Bradbury's work, First Contact was a filmed historical essay, marshalling its material to critique an episode of Australian colonialism. After First Contact, we went back to New Guinea to make observational films about contemporary society, two of them over 6 years. And in the process, we developed the methodology that I've just been describing. And in the confused tribal melee of post-independence Papua New Guinea, we learned a lesson that I've never forgotten. If you want to make an observational film that has something significant to say, you cannot afford to take sides. Jolet's neighbours looked at the fractious relationship between wealthy, mixed-race coffee planter Jolet and his subsistence-level tribal neighbours who sold him his land and who lived all around him. It's true we were initially drawn to making the film by the obvious disparity between the two. But had we viewed Joe as some kind of neo-colonial exploiter, we'd not only have been guilty of gross oversimplification, we'd have very likely missed the real story running through his fraught relationship with the Garniga tribe. Jolet's neighbours had a theatrical run in America. Quote, "Adapt or die is the message," said the New York Times Review. But it's a message delivered with grace and understanding by Mr. Connolly and Miss Anderson, who never editorialise, never blame, never explain too much. They have the good sense to allow their characters to express themselves in all of their confused truculence, so they emerge neither as heroes or villains, but as wounded humans struggling to prosper and to understand. I cannot tell you how proud I was when I read that review. In observational film, there can be no imposed political or ideological framework through which you view people and unfolding events. No polemical intent. No villains or victims. Nothing but a total attempt to understand what is actually happening in front of you. What counts is acute observation, vigilance against conscious bias, awareness of unconscious bias. No axes to grind. The approach, if you like, must be psychological, not political, novelistic, not journalistic. That's the discipline, the power and the promise of the genre. Throw away your megaphone and loftier vistas will open up, both artistic and intellectual. In the mid-90s, we made a film at Leichhardt Council about its mayor, Larry Hand. Council and the mayor were both highly regarded at the time by the left. But sections of the left were outraged when Rats of the Ranks revealed the brutal politics surrounding the 1994 mayoral election. Many colleagues thought that I'd let the side down. The film is now universally valued for what it says about political number crunching and is a favourite draw card at ALP fundraisers. Someone once asked what our political intentions were in our 2001 film Facing the Music. I said we had no such intentions. We couldn't afford them. Intentions, political or otherwise, can be dangerous in observational film. They tend to produce tunnel vision, characters who dance to your tune, missed opportunities. I'm coming to the view that the only framework that can be safely applied to observing the world in all its unpredictable complexity is curiosity. Now, when I wrote this, I did not know that Professor Anne Boyd was going to be sitting in the audience. So I'll plough on. Hope I haven't got too close to the bone. Facing the Music's central character is the composer Professor Anne Boyd, head of Sydney University's music department during the coalition government's economic rationalist squeeze on tertiary funding. Yes, this issue influenced our decision to camp in Professor Boyd's office for 15 months, but that is not why we made the film. That would have put the cart before the horse. Anne Boyd is why we made the film. I love the way that she evolves from, prissy blink of reactionary to fiercely partisan activist, picketing the university, leading downtown protest marches. Her activism is spectacular but brief, bringing on the emotional crisis that forces her into making a choice. Persist with the self-destructive but ego-enhancing bureaucratic game of keeping her department afloat, or try to rekindle the creative drive that's been suppressed for years, the composing that gives her life its real meaning and purpose. I think that's both novelistic and cinematic, a deeply satisfying process to document and dramatise in a film which draws its raw material from unfolding real life. Public versus private is a deeply divisive issue in Australian education. MLC Burwood, the setting for Mrs. Carey's concert, is a privileged, single-sex, unashamedly elitist private school. We didn't give that a second's thought. What drew us to the school was a feisty, remarkable woman in rampant pursuit of excellence, with a bunch of feisty, remarkable schoolgirls to work her will upon. Others can argue the merits or otherwise of our education system. We settled into MLC in 2008 because it ticked all the boxes. Interesting people, out of the spotlight, potential conflict, something at stake, beautiful music. Sufficient justification to once more launch ourselves onto that unexplored river. And talk about serendipity. What writer could conjure up in his or her wildest dreams an Irish she? An Iris was merely the counterpoint. As David Tiley wrote in Screen Hub, we watch a bunch of modern young women confront themselves, test their courage, and find emotional resources to open their hearts to the music, their destiny, and a civilization. When Mrs. Carey's concert was screening in cinemas, Sophie and I used to hang around until the end and watch people coming out, more often than not red-eyed and sniffling. This I noted with considerable satisfaction, because when I lecture on observational documentary, I always end by saying to my students that if they want to teach or preach, fine, but if they want to make films that move people, that last, then they should never forget Kevin Brownlow's definition of the filmmaker's overriding responsibility to hold people spellbound in darkness, to make them laugh and cry. Thank you.
The last two can keep it about 15 minutes each, then we'll have 30 minutes to wind up.
Thank you, Jared. So I'm going to talk, actually, it seems that we're talking about our passions today. We've taken advantage of the situation. And so I'm actually going to talk about the music in the film and the way we used it in the edit, like how we considered it while we were editing the film. Can I have a little show of hands who's actually seen the film? Majority, very good. So I want you to just cast your mind back to the opening scene where you enter on stage to the Opera House and there is a young girl standing on stage waiting for her moment to enter with her solo. And this actually was the moment that brought Bob and I into wanting to do this film. Because we were making this film really for the school as a DVD for the parents, and this was their 2007 concert. And when we watched that moment, especially down the end of a lens, you know, up close, right there with this girl, and the instant transformation that she went through when she was this nervous young thing, and then suddenly, when she makes that sound on the violin, she just disappears into the music. And it was instantly compelling and moving. And we didn't know anything about this girl. We didn't know her name, nothing. We just had her on the end of the camera. And then we made some inquiries. We thought, wow, that was such an amazing moment. And then Karen, Mrs. Carey, told us a little bit about her backstory and how it had been a bit of a struggle to get her up on stage. And that kind of added an extra layer of when the next time we watched it. And really, in lots of ways, that was a sort of a key moment that drove a lot of our decisions in how we edited the film. We thought, imagine if we filmed the next concert and we filmed the whole journey getting to that next concert, and then you see those kids on stage, but you know them, you've got to know them, you've got to know a little bit about their backstory, but you also get to know a little bit more about the music. And we thought, how much more powerful would those moments be? So I'm going to give you a little case study of just one of the pieces of music that we used throughout the film. Now, we actually followed six pieces of music in Mrs. Carey's concert, and as part of the process of the shoot, we made it part of our kind of discipline to make sure that we were at the rehearsal for every single one of these pieces of music. So that was a lot of rehearsals that we went to, and a lot of setting up microphones and rushing to other rooms. But that was part of the discipline, and we made sure that we were there for everyone. And so when we got to the edit, we had an overwhelming amount of material. A lot of it was double camera footage, so that wasn't so bad. And because we were shooting music, we probably let the camera run a little bit longer than we normally would. And so when we got to the edit, the first thing we did was we edited the concert and the days in the Opera House, because it was really the only time that all the characters were in the one place at the one time, following the one sort of semi-lineal narrative. So we thought, we'll start there. And that ended up being a really great decision because it showed us basically all the delivery points of the film. Now, you know the delivery point, our climax, was Emily playing the brook. And so we knew when we started the edit, we wanted the audience to be able to sit through as much of that concerto and be utterly compelled as possible. But we also had several other pieces that we also needed to do that with. So I think the brook was a little obvious and you followed that. So I'm going to take you through the Ravel and just show you some of the choices that we made. Now, there were a few things that we looked for in each of the scenes, and they had to kind of tick at least one of these boxes. So one was we wanted you to get familiar with the music. So we made sure that each time you heard that piece of music, it was the same part of the music, the catchiest section, the main motif or theme. So by the time you got to the concert, you were a little bit familiar with it. Another part was we attached a character to the piece of music. So I think Mrs. Carey's piece of music was the Aida. So you see her managing the Aida throughout, and then she goes on to conduct it. With the Ravel, there was an ensemble of characters, so you meet a few of the characters and they sort of add another layer to that piece of music. And then there was emotion. Now, the emotion could have been the character's emotion and what they brought to the piece of music, but also what was being asked of the girls. What emotion are you putting into this piece of music? And that was a very strong theme that we picked up just through observing the staff at MLC throughout. And I think, you know, the scene with what Emily was going to put in the brook was a key scene. And then the final thing that we looked for also was a technical breakdown, something that gave you a little sense of really how they got their fingers around it, what was in that piece of music physically for them. And so I'm going to take you through, and you can see how each of these elements, and sometimes more than one, are in each of these scenes. It's not every scene that the Ravel appears throughout the film, but it's just a few of the key ones, and I'll sort of explain to you some of the choices of why we picked those particular scenes. So hopefully this is all going to work smoothly. So the first time the girls meet the music was at music camp, and so we thought, well, let's have the audience meet the girls and the music at that same time.
Let's fill the bottom up. Bass, what do you have? Okay, now let's add you. See what's happening. Do they have 6/8? Let's listen to you. Let's listen to you too. You guys have like 7 quarters. And what do you have? Show us what you have. She has like triplets. So, hectic.
Very brief. But you get the first little inkling of that piece of music. Obviously, it's devilishly hard. So that's something that came up many times. So the next time, this is actually the very next time you come back to it, is when Louise Keller, who's the head of strings.
Coming back to the Ravel.
It's just hard. It is hard.
Lynn, for example, gets the musical bit. She really does. That beautiful chin. Da, 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 da. She's playing that beautifully. Christy's finding it really hard. There's one or two bars that are very difficult. She's got to go and shift bows and shift positions, and it's really hard. And you can see it in her face. She's not happy. Poor darling. It's hard.
It is hard.
So we meet our first character, one of the ensemble players, Christy, and her viola. The other layer to this scene also is this sort of almost conspiratorial relationship that Mrs. Carey has with the head of strings, and they're always consulting each other. So that was another layer. And one of the things that Bob talks about with the scenes is that they've got to carry more than one load. And so, we looked for scenes that did have a few extra elements. But also the other thing is to try to have a scene that shows you what's happening rather than having someone tell you. So obviously you have people teaching music a lot and they do tell you a lot of these elements. But we were able to sort of inject, Louise showing the difficulty of the piece. And then we have the other little follow-up session that she has where Mrs. Carey suggests to Christy that, she has a special workshop on that piece, and this is just a little element of the workshop, and just seeing the piece of music always got a great reaction from the audience.
Now, without the music. That's it, don't slow down. Okay, I'm going to give a beat. 1, 2, 3, 4. Rest. Easy. Okay, you practice like that. Now, that's the next one.
Yeah. It just says hard, doesn't it, in one image. So also the way we used the Ravel throughout this film, it ended up being a little bit of a counterpoint soundtrack for the naughty girls, or those naughty moments, and mainly because of the sort of mysterious nature of the music. And so we ended up having sort of bookending. Well, here we go. Bookending some of the naughty scenes with the Ravel.
You need to forget that you're a lovely, well brought up teenage girl in suburban Sydney, and you've got to start thinking more primeval.
it's a little bit more harsh. Let's try it.
Can you write me a note?
So that was Emily about to tell the composer character that she'd been accused of taking drugs. So, you know, we had that kind of, it was sort of a lovely idea of them being primeval. And, so we got to sort of use that in a thematic way as well, as a nice counterpoint, which was very enjoyable. Now, you're starting to get to know a bit of their faces too, and the way they, you know, just through their faces, reading how they're taking on this music as well. And one of the characters on the double bass, Aurora, who is everything spelled out on her face. I think you only hear her say one or two words in the whole thing, but she, it was interesting how the audience really delighted in her character, just purely in her facial reactions to all the classes and the rehearsals that she was in. And this is a little moment that carries lots of loads in it, actually, and I'll dissect it afterwards.
I'm telling you that of all the pieces in the opera house, the Ravel is the hardest.
I didn't realise I'd missed so many rehearsals.
Well, you had. One more, and I'll replace you. We're expecting you to come up there and take every advantage of that very tiny little half an hour week in a week.
Oh, yesterday I had an art excursion, and the week before we had a PE excursion.
The music comes first. That's my interest, is the music. The music is always first. I'm not trying to be a beast over this, but it's a privilege to play there. It's a serious privilege. So I'm putting the pressure on you because we're behind schedule. And I don't want to have this conversation again, all right?
Sure.
So we get to meet Aurora. And feel for her terribly. And but the other loads that are happening in this scene is obviously it's reinforcing Mrs. Carey's ambition for the piece of Ravel in particular, but for the concert and the parameters that she's setting for excellence. And you also get a sense of all the other things that are going on in these girls' lives. I mean, they're not just doing music. She's got all these excursions, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's another nice layer that you get to know about these girls. And then, you know, it reinforces just that the Ravel in particular is still something that she's a little bit worried about as one of the harder pieces to do. Now that. So now we get to the opera house and we meet the third member of the ensemble, Millie, the cellist.
One piece in the whole thing I'm scared of. That's the Ravel. Mm-hmm. Listen, you're doing so well in everything, aren't you?
This is so overwhelming.
You're just doing so well. Just wash your eyes.
Yeah.
A few deep breaths. A stiff whiskey. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. All right.
Yeah.
And then a rest.
I'm sorry if you like this. No, you're so with it.
So mean at me and I'm just, like, absolutely.
Yeah,
we
know.
So, and Mrs. Carey, I sort of cut a bit short there, but she goes on to explain that Millie is in every piece in the opera house, so her breakdown is pretty expected, really, at this point in time. And so, by this stage, we're hoping that you've got a sense for the piece of the music, you've got all these different characters and little emotional journeys in there, and obviously we've done this with all six pieces that appear throughout the concert at the end. And so we're hoping, you know, the audience then has all those layers and ideas in their head when they actually finally get to see the performance. And this is the performance. was a nice little a demonstration of at least sort of one little aspect that we considered in the film. And as I said, we put the same level of sort of detail in all of the pieces that we managed throughout the film. And I'd like to introduce Karen Carey on this.
Okay, I'm sure you all really enjoyed the film and loved it. And it's obviously a very successful film. And a lot of people have spoken to me and said how much they loved it, and they've all given very different reasons for why they do like it. But for me, I have to say, the film sums up what I really believe it was what education's about. And that's about passion, that music education is about skill-based education, which comes out in that film. It's comprehensive. I'll talk about the project-based learning later. But also, it demonstrates that every student is able to succeed given the opportunity, which is a very important aspect of that film. Passion is the first one. Now, I make no bones that I'm a passionate musician, and I nearly call myself an obsessive music educator. To me, it's very, very important. And I love seeing students succeed musically, and I love seeing them develop emotionally, and I like seeing the stature that they develop through actually the process that we go through. And I feel that, and this is actually done through creating these big projects and allowing students to sort of put themselves into a situation which is not comfortable at first, but they rise out of it much better for it. So that's one of the... And I have to say that at MLC, I'm working with a group of colleagues who are all passionate about music, and we all share the same vision about excellence, skill-based education, putting on big projects to create opportunities for every single person. And I think the most important thing about the passion and the film, that music education is for everybody. We have a system at MLC, or I talk about project-based learning. And for me, that was a passion which began very early. And I think I alluded to it in the film that I come from a very small country town, and I had a very small limited experience. All I did was I learnt piano from the nuns. I sang in a school choir, which my father directed, and I sang a very small choir, and I sang in a church choir, which my father directed, and it wasn't very much really. But when I look back on it, I'm very grateful for that experience because it was community. It was a community experience. When I first actually experienced project-based learning was at the conservatorium, and I alluded to this in the film, that one of the very first pieces that I came in contact with a student was St. Matthew Passion, which is a gigantic work, and I loved it. And it was Newcastle in those days was a small institution, and to do this, that were they the choir and the orchestra liaised with the city orchestra and also the cathedral choir and put on this gigantic performance in the cathedral. And it's one of the most memorable experiences I've ever had in my life, and I still talk about it because it made such a marked impression on me, and I kept wanting to do it all the time. And so that even when I've been teaching in state schools, that's what I believed in as well. And I can still talk about it that Marsden High School, for instance, we had not very much in the way of choral singing, and I think the only way that I could institute that was to start a parent-teacher-student choir, which I did. And we got a lot of parents and a lot of staff and eventually dragged in a lot of students. And we did choruses from the Messiah, but the most memorable one we did was the whole of the Mozart Requiem, and it was just stunning. And I still get reactions from children to say how memorable that was and how exciting it was. And I think the culmination of that performance, we were actually asked to perform in the secondary school's choral concert, and it caused quite a sensation. And even all those projects that we had done in state schools, I still get students telling me, after they'd seen the film and made contact with me again, to say, wow, I still remember that and what an impression it made on me. And since that time, I've always wanted my daughters or my sons or whoever they are, they're married with grandchildren or whatever they're doing. I don't know how old I am. But it made a very marked impression on them, which is very important. And I also like to mention also those secondary school choral festivals in those days. That was when students from a whole different lot of schools came together and performed major works. And the one I really remember was Belshazzar's Feast. And I remember getting the score and thinking, that is just ridiculous. We can't do that. That is too hard. I slogged away and got the kids motivated to do it. We went in there. And the transformation, having done a work like that, was exhilarating. And I can still remember one of the students on stage cried at the end of it. And I said, what was that all about? It was stunning. And she said, I will never get a chance to do that again unless I become a professional musician. Now, that made a profound impression on me. So when I decided to move to MLC, that actually made me decide on how I was actually going to conduct that department. It was a big learning curve. Okay, going back, what is music education?
Well, music education, is, for me, it's definitely skill-based. Without skills, you can learn nothing. You have to have, it's got to be a skill-based education, and once you have skills, you have success. Success breeds success. Also, that it's comprehensive, that it covers a wide genre of music, because it just does. I mean, I'm talking about classical music, art music, I'm talking about world music, I'm also talking about popular music. All those areas of music are actually encompassed, should be encompassed in a good music education. I do say that I focus on art music as a core part of the curriculum, and the reason I do that is I believe that art music teaches us a lot about our society, our history. It's an essential part of human development, and not to know this is not education for me. So it's got to be a major part of what we do. Also, art music actually teaches us how music functions, how it works, and actually how it evolved. So that's a major part of what we do at MLC. But to make it comprehensive, we are in touch with all of them. And one of the big projects we do is a world music project, and I think that's important because we link the studies of folk music all around the world with art music, and that creates numerous opportunities for composition. But all this wide variety and wide encompassing genre for everybody is, to me, what it's about. Oh, there's an example. I played that as an example, an example of world music we did. And to do that, we brought in professional experts working with the staff, and we taught a whole stack of music from all different sorts of countries, and we performed it, we learned about it, we danced it. And to me, that was the most exciting experience because the students, as I said, linked composition based on that medium, but we also linked it with art music as well. That was just an example. And the reason I spoke about that one, because that's in direct contrast to what we did for the Opera House concert, because the Opera House concert focus is art music. Okay, I think I alluded to why music is important there. As the essential word is, I do think it's life-changing. And in the era today, modern education, people are talking about the most important thing. That's still flicking through. The most important thing in education is creativity. Creativity is the central thing in education to move forward. And music is the ultimate creative art. It's abstract. It teaches imagination. Creativity demands imagination. It teaches it. If it's a skill-based education, it teaches defined or acute listening skills. It teaches coordination. It teaches fine motor skills. It teaches performance at a high level, and the ultimate, it teaches creativity through composition. It's in young children. It teaches music through play. It teaches cooperation, it teaches community. Everything that you want for a good education in any discipline comes through in music. So it's absolutely essential. I'd like to talk about music in primary school. Music in a primary school is absolutely essential. And that might seem obvious, but it's actually not in our country. If any educational value or emotional states happen very early in children. And so if we want music education to really develop or become important, it should happen in primary schools. Because in primary schools, I mention again that it can be taught through play, it teaches acute listening skills, it teaches coordination, it teaches, you can teach all aspects of literacy through music. And there's so much research to prove that
learning music in a skill-based fashion greatly enhances literacy, numeracy, all the things that we're trying to achieve. So one of my main missions is to make sure that music education with a specialist happens in every school. If we could achieve that, our schools would be very different places. The other thing I'd like to mention is that it's a must for music in the secondary school, because what's actually happening now is that not every school has music. Some schools do. When they come into Year 7, what happens is that every child is at a different level. You could be sitting in a Year 7 class with someone who has an MSA and someone who's never actually read a note or even attempted to play a piece of music or doesn't even know what a crotchet or a quaver is. And for both sides of the spectrum, it's very disconcerting, and it's actually not right. It doesn't happen in any other discipline. Most kids would come having done maths, for instance, they'd be approximately at the same level. But in music, there is such a discrepancy of what happens in a Year 7 class. At NLC, we've actually made a great attempt how to solve that, and we do it by bringing all the girls together at one time, and we teach singing, and then we break them up according to where they are at the level of experience that they're at that current moment. And so then we can actually teach them songs, and they can develop the skills that they're learning, like composition or anything about the music they're doing, at the level where they're actually at now, and they can develop at their own particular rate without being held back by people who can't do it or being intimidated by those who can. I'd like to briefly talk about this one, about world-class models. There's three I'd like to mention. One is El Sistema. El Sistema is a system in South America, in Venezuela. It is actually funded by the government, and it's based on the premise that if you nourish a person's soul, they will learn to feed and clothe themselves. And you see wonderful examples of little children up to adults who living in poor conditions who are motivated by going to a school every week where they learn the fundamentals, basic of music, and they learn to perform, and they learn to perform at the most extraordinary high level. And you can see around Venezuela about 200 choirs and orchestra operating at the same level as we are, or probably equivalent to the Sydney Youth Orchestra. It is really exciting. And the exuberance and the love which actually goes into that teaching is an inspiration to everybody. And there's a lot of countries around the world who are inspired by that model and are trying to implement it. That's my big passion. I want to go there and observe that for myself. It is just something. It's really extraordinary. And if they can do it in a country like that with government support, we should be able to do it here. The other model, of course, is Finland. Now, that was a conscious attempt, again, where the government decided after the World War they wanted to unite the country together, bring some sort of unity or national feeling back to the country. And what they did was they invested in music, and they invested in music education. And the results actually speak for themselves. The standard of schools and education is extraordinary. The standard of music is extraordinary. And also, it's a great equaliser. They don't have the need for private schools. Their schools, there's no private schools, they're all government schools, and the opportunities are equal for everybody, which I think is extraordinarily important. That's what we want here. The other one is Richard Gill. Now, he is an Australian. I hope you've all heard of Richard Gill, but he is a world-class model. And he has probably been the biggest influence on me and my department, because he is passionate about music, and he knows that music is for everybody. He knows what what music can do for children, but he has the same recipe whether you're he's teaching a kindergarten class, or he's teaching a secondary class, or whether he's teaching a tertiary class, or he's teaching professionals. It's the same. He works from the premises of good music. He talks about developing their skills. He talks about motivation and encouragement. It's really hard to describe until you see it, but when you see him in action, he's just extraordinary. And I can say I've done DVDs of him teaching in a primary school, and it's the same thing. You can see him teaching performance and singing very simply, but the idea is to get students to perform and create music, make it up, to compose. That's the most important thing. And he does the same thing in a high school. I've seen him do the same thing. I even watched him do a workshop on the Mozart Jupiter, where he taught the students
to analyse it, to think about it, to play it, to compose from it. And he had those students engaged from 8:15 to 3:15, and they loved it. He's our inspiration for MLC, and it's somebody we should all be listening to what he says, because he makes an extraordinary difference. I think I've explained a little bit about the MLC experience. It's virtually creating a complete community where we have music from the kindergarten right through to year 12, where every student is involved in music right across the board. Everybody can be involved performing in the Opera House concerts at some level. And the big thing I'd like to mention, even about Iris, the point is Iris could have been in or out. We chose to have Iris in so that she would have a chance to succeed. So it's for everybody, and those who love music get a chance to excel. The last point I'll make is, how can the MLC experience translate to other schools? Well, I'd like to point out that at MLC, the school has invested a lot in music education, in the belief that it's profoundly significant for every individual, and it has far-reaching benefits for the school community as a whole. And if there's going to be an improvement of music education across this country, it's important that governments invest in music in public schools. It's really, really important. And given the overwhelming research, what music does for education and the individual, I just don't understand why they don't do it, and they should do it. And the other thing I'd like to mention is that there's a new document being put out for the national curriculum, and the one for music, I have to say, is a huge disappointment. Because what we need in music education is passionate educators who want to make a difference, who believe in skills and creating opportunities. This document has quite the opposite effect. It's a very generalised document. It just talks about virtually like just experiencing music. I hate to use the word, but it's a dumb down. It's actually a regression. And I think that we need to think about that, because if we're going to make a difference, those aspects of having music in private, in public schools, and the idea of musical excellence will change the nature of our schools completely. I'm sorry that was a political sermon, but I couldn't help it.
So we go to questions discussion. We'll finish no later than 7, so we've got about maximum 25 minutes. May finish a bit earlier. Okay, so we're off to questions and discussion. So just go back to, just start with Bob, the point you made. I mean, you're making the point, and Karen, you come up to me, you're making the point earlier, and when you speak, just speak all in the microphone.
Okay.
You're making the point earlier that you managed in that computer scene to get the girls to behave like you weren't there, but you were there, and in Rats in the Ranks you made people, well, people said things that you normally would have thought that clever people as they were wouldn't have said them because you were there. So how long does it take to get people to relax as if you're not there, or do the people just do it because they like being in front of the camera? What's the explanation?
It varies from film to film. With younger people, it's more difficult, and the circumstances have got to be right as well. The reason why it was quite difficult initially at MLC was that we only got our claws into these kids for 40 minutes each week, maybe twice, by which I mean that they were all very, very busy. They've all got a full curriculum. It's not a music school. It's a comprehensive school with a very good music department. And so the kids would come across for 2 periods a week or 3, and that was when we got them. And so our attachment to them was periodic, whereas, for example, with Anne, and she could well probably answer this question better than I can, but with Anne, we were sitting in Anne's office for 15 months. And the same with Larry Han. I remember initially Larry, if anything sensitive came up, he would say, could you please leave the room? And we would go out and then we'd come back. And then after about 6 months, when we were there every day, we became, in a sense, his friends and his confidants. We knew more about the politics that were going on at the council than anyone else did. And I'll just briefly say that at one point there, Larry's on the phone to one of his party members who's ratting on him, and he's pleading with her to stay. And there's a knock on the door, and it's his secretary of 3 years standing. She comes in to get him to sign something, which he does, and then she stands there, and then he's still got his hand over the phone, and he says, would you please leave now and close the door behind you? And he waits until his secretary leaves the room. And then he turns back to this woman who was ratting on him and starts to plead with her again. In other words, he's got back his privacy, except that 100 million people are watching him. So I don't know what that says about the influence of the camera, but it's the most important thing is the relationship that you develop with these people. That is what's key.
I think it also helps that if you're in a very busy environment and people are just very wrapped up with what they're doing, and you do fall by the wayside somewhat after the first, really, month, I would say.
Mm. Karen used to come in dressed to the nines for about 3 weeks.
I was going to say, that was my experience. I dressed up for a week, and after that I thought, he'd say, you can't wear that, it's got spots on it, or you can't wear that, that's got stripes on it. And I thought, blah, too busy, I just gave up and became myself. Took a week.
Robin.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. I guess I should confess to having no musical abilities whatsoever. And having escaped from school, which directly means theatre and drama and debating, etc., if one had no musical talents. My question is, in terms of the editing, you're dealing with children. My recollection is that none of them came out of the film particularly badly. But how would you have dealt with the situation if you had been observing a child in unflattering circumstances and issues of consent when obviously they are not old enough to consent, with their unflattering profile being in the public arena for the rest of their lives?
Mm. So who wants to tackle that? Either Sophie or Bob, I think.
Well, firstly, we did do a series of consultations with the school when we started, and every kid, 1,200 release forms we got from assigned by every parent and every child. So there was an element of them knowing that we were there and what we were doing. We did film extremely sensitive things. We did. And that was actually part of what we had asked for in total access, because really you can't edit while you're filming. You edit in the editing suite. And so you just use your own moral compass. And when it comes to the edit in the end. And so we did make choices along that line. But, you know, actually, in the end, the story didn't really find us. We never found ourselves in a situation going, gee, I wish we could show that kid being particularly awful, but we can't. In the end, the story didn't actually put us in that situation. So I guess we were kind of lucky. But we did, you know, there is sensitive stuff in the rushes, but, you know, we look after them.
So was it go off to a library somewhere? Where does it all, where the rushes go to?
We have them.
We in our earlier films, Robin absolutely insisted on this, and that was no matter. And we did films for Film Australia and so on, the rushes went to their vaults. But we made them sign a contract which said that none of this material can be used without our written permission, and so we basically control the material, and that's just a standard thing. A lot of people don't do that, but on several occasions now, particularly in places like New Guinea with our rushes there, people wanted to use that material in ways that I thought were inappropriate, so I just simply said no.
Yeah.
Jeff?
It seems to me that a possible lesson or something can be derived from this: if subsidies were redirected away from things like Opera Australia and the Sydney Symphony Orchestra to education in schools, we might encourage enough interest in the population for art music for them to be able to survive without subsidy. In other words, what about redirecting the way governments spend money?
I think it's a question to Karen, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. That's a really hard one. I don't think I want to answer that, except to say that I think they need funding. I think schools need funding. I think education is a prime concern in this country, and I think that we should be investing on every level, but I'm actually advocating for more in music. And those bodies, by the way, Sydney Symphony, Music Aviva, contribute a lot to music education, but my point is they are not schools. Schools need to be highly developed in music education, and then these people are the greatest support that you can actually possibly have. They become partners.
Okay, so we go down the back. Just wait for the microphone. Speaking to the microphone.
Yes, question for Karen. I was just wondering, obviously these children were doing a huge amount of work on the musical side. Did you come into contact with other members of staff in the school about the other obligations that they had in their other subjects and presented to?
The concept, this project has been developed over for 20 years. The Opera House concert has been going for that long. And I think over a period of time, the culture is developed in the school where the school, whole school staff and the community see it as vitally important. So those conflicts actually are not there. And I think there's a culture of actually support for us. Mind you, I do have to go into battle for some students, particularly for their private practice, but the idea of the musical rehearsal schedule program is supported absolutely, but all the emotional context, I think we get incredible support, really.
I think I'd have to just give a caveat to that and say that there's a great many teachers that when they look at what Karen does with bewildered wonderment.
But do parents at the school believe that they're spending too much time on music?
Well, I actually haven't interviewed them. I actually don't know, but I...
Well, they signed a release form.
I don't get... Put this way, I don't get very many complaints. I think I get more support than I actually get complaints. I think that's a good way of looking at it. You might get occasional one, think they might have to do one too many rehearsals, but it's not an overwhelming, it's a very majority, it's very much in the minority.
So we go here, then we go down to Terry Sheehan. Yep.
After I saw this film, I heard several teachers from government schools complaining that they could not do this in their schools.
In actual fact, they're right. But they can't. But one of the things I'm actually saying when I made that first point was that the collaboration between institutions and schools is very important. And one of the important things that in those secondary school choral concerts I talked about, that's where a lot of schools came together and produced magnificent things. That's when I spoke about my experience at the conservatorium, because we couldn't have done it on our own. It was this collaboration. But we've... We can do it. We can do this whole thing at MLC because there is institutional support for it, and the school actually invests in it because it's important.
I think also this is not so much a question of privilege, which is what the question implies. It's more a question of choice. Mm-hmm. There are a great many very wealthy private schools who do not make that choice, who do not invest in music, just as there are a large number of public schools that do. And the choice in a country like Finland, I mean, every single school in Finland has an orchestra. That's a choice that they made.
So, Terry Sheehan?
Given the centrality of the music to the education, and given the involvement of all the students in the Opera House concert, what proportion of your students take music as a subject for the HSC, which is where they get their passport to somewhere else?
Actually, not a large number, to be quite honest, because music for the HSC and the extension is very advanced. That's not my mission, why everybody should do music. If they do it to a level where they can perform in an orchestra, we have lots of kids playing in orchestra who are playing at a very high level. We've got kids who are highly gifted, who do very well at music, but decide they'd like to do drama for the HSC, or they might want to do legal studies. That's a choice. But it doesn't mean to say that the education for them hasn't been successful, because some of those very elite musicians who decide to do other things, because in the end they decide they're not going to do music when they leave school, but they will do it on a different level, but not professionally. That's choices they can make, but that's not my main mission, that they all have to do it for the HSC to make me successful, or what we're doing successful. That's not the point. But I take your question.
No, I know.
No.
As a very satisfied grandparent, I wasn't.
Yeah.
Happy
I didn't mean that to be negative. I was just trying to say that the fact that a good music program is that people can choose to do it, or it's offered to everybody. At MLC, I said the big mantra is that nobody can leave that school and say they didn't have an opportunity. They've all had the same opportunity. And I still believe the big mantra is that every child has the potential for music. This business about that it just means that they've got to be talented is not true. It just means hard work. And there's some people, students and their parents, who make that choice. They've decided to put the hard yards in. But the potential's in all of us, and it depends on how we nurture it, whether everybody can actually reach their full potential. So some people decide to take that one step further, others don't.
There's a question down there, and then we're going over here. Yeah.
Yes, also addressed to Karen. Hello, Karen. Given the value of publicity, I'm wondering if the success of the film and the exposure it's had has raised the profile of music in the school, given it added credibility? Has it improved the number of
In our school or in other schools? In our
school? Has it increased the number of students studying music? Has it made them more serious, take it more seriously?
I think so. I actually think what it does is actually make them realise what they've actually achieved and how great it is. I mean, I have a lot of students come to me and say, wow, this is great. This is our school that did this. I think the other point, that where it has raised the profile, is actually in some even government schools. Because one of the best things for the film about for me is that I've been asked to go and talk in some primary schools where the parents have said, hey, we want this in our schools. And the parents have get together and they're actually raising money so that their mission is that every child can actually learn an instrument in their school. And they want to, and I'm the inspiration for that, or our school's the inspiration for that. And if that's the success of it or the effect of it, I'm thrilled. But, and the other point is, it's parents who are doing that, not government. That's the difference.
So we go...
Your father.
Hang on just a second. We go...
Your father.
Yes. We go Craig and over.
Look, I was late, so forgive me if I'm going over something we've already discussed, but apart from the brilliant editing job, congratulations, I sat and watched it in Leichhardt almost, and it was almost gone, and I was about one of very few in the audience, and I just went out of the film feeling I was on cloud nine. But the editing's brilliant, the kids and everything, but that star bit, you pick a star. I mean, have you explained all this tonight? I mean, how do you... You've obviously got to wait for that person to come to you. And you've got this brilliant group of teachers. It's a two-pronged question. Can we support that kind of excellent teamwork, music teaching, with the sort of graduates we're spinning out to do a better job of music education? And how do you go about bringing that star every year or every second year to your concert performance? Because it was just marvellous to watch. Was it Emily?
Yeah.
There's one point there where she raises her eyebrows when you say something very fitting, as if she's really, you know, fed up with all this, and then she ends up going along with it, and it comes from her, not from you.
Am I answering that one or somebody else?
Well, I think Karen, yeah.
That's a hard one. I mean, does she come to me? I mean, she's a girl that came into the school. She was actually a scholar at the school. She came on a music scholarship. And I've been watching her for a long time. She was a girl that obviously had potential. I actually always thought she was musical. There was other problems that got in the road. But I think with this teamwork, I mean, every student, we look at every student the same as Emily. It's just that they chose to look at Emily, and she actually happened to have the role for the concert at that time. There's always somebody who's actually going to do a concerto or something like that. We're always looking for someone to do that. That happened to be her time, but I've been looking at her for a long time, along with others, even like Doretta we talked before. But it's a conscious process, and it's a lot of strategies put in place to help these girls reach where they're going. It really is a conscious decision. She was... She just happened to be there at the time. She was just one of the ones who I was earmarking for that particular concert. Does that make sense? I think the other question you're sort of actually alluding to is teacher training. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Well, just very quickly on this, because we're getting to the...
Yes, I have. And actually, in fact, that's one of the things I've been allowed to do over 20 years is actually choose my team, which has been fantastic, and I look at them for what they can do. But I think there's a real issue of teacher training in this country, particularly for... or any teacher, but for music teachers. And in primary school... there's no specialists in primary schools, very few, and the generalist teachers get minimum exposure to music education. Half of them feel inadequate to do so. So there's a real big problem that you cannot get excellent without properly trained, passionate teachers, and they need to be at the ground level up.
Wasn't there a time when...
Her.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Tell us.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask Karen, there was a time when every single primary school teacher had to have level of music education.
Well, I can explain that. Richard Gill tells me that. And my father was one of them. And when he started teaching in a primary school, and he had to learn solfège and solfège and everything with a tuning fork, and he could train choirs. He had to have incredible pitch, but they did music training as an integral part of being a primary school teacher. Now, that is not the case anymore, and I think that's the tragedy.
So just quickly to Bob and Sophie, would it work as well without Emily? I mean, how dependent are you on your talents that have produced?
Oh, well, completely. Yeah. We don't really make process films. We try to make real-life dramas, and real-life dramas require characterisation and plot development. I mean, we have to operate under basically the same set of rules in a way that that fiction writers do, except that we've got to see the story within the material. And you very quickly, I mean, we used to write, as I do with every film, every 3 or 4 weeks, you just pass a sort of a radar over it, and then you write several pages of analysis about what's happening, what seems to be the plot lines developing, who seems to be important here, you know, to what extent should we start to concentrate on them as opposed to others. I mean, in the old days when you were shooting 16mm film and it was $3 a second to expose, they were really crucial questions. Not so much now with digital tape, which is very cheap. You can afford to shoot a lot of material, which of course you do. But you're always having to make choices. And the choices that you hopefully get onto as quickly as possible are these key characters that appear to be, that there appears to be a dramatic arc developing that you're going to be able to follow.
We've got two final questions over there, and finish with Craig. Yeah.
My question was, what was the reaction of the girls, and particularly Iris, when they saw the film?
They were the first to see it publicly. So we had a cast and crew screening at the film school. And really they just laughed themselves silly. They just thought it was hilarious, mostly. And Iris didn't turn up for that event. And so it took a few months later. But what she did, and she actually came round to our house with a friend to watch it. And they too laughed their way through the film. And look, she actually had a really amazing response to it. I don't think they really knew what we were doing. I mean, they really thought we were a bit silly, really, because they didn't think what they were doing was particularly interesting. So, and also to see their story sort of unfold without us sort of going, and here we are at MLC school, you know, without any of that kind of editorial element, was also, was kind of disquieting for them, really, in a way, just to see them unfold like a drama. And Iris in particular really was, I think, I'll say it, I think she was kind of impressed by that in a way. And she really liked how honest the portrayal was of everyone, you know, including herself. And she actually stopped and thought about it for a bit. So, but we did ask her, why did you actually sing at the end? Because we really weren't expecting that. And she thought about it for a while and she said, look, you know, I just, Mrs. Carey just tried so hard. I just, it was the least I could do. I was just glad she turned up.
Final question, Craig.
Karen, you tell a very compelling story about the need for music. And it's sort of interesting that you say it's part of the curriculum, that we need to increase it. Now, that obviously needs money. And I think given it's sort of timely what you've said tonight, because we're going through the Olympics, and already we're underperforming supposedly in the Olympics, and the debate's already started about more money for sport. So what's the killer blow that the music world can deliver? Is it through more talented filmmakers getting out there and producing and getting more exposure for music? How do you convince the politicians and the funders that music comes before sport? Because that's actually, I think, what's going to happen over the next couple of years.
That is the ultimate question, and who knows the answer to that? And probably Bob, they're probably right, through filmmaking like that, to show what children can do, and this could be for every person. But I think the other thing is that we should think about is this introducing of this standardised testing, which doesn't do anything really except pigeonhole students and pigeonhole schools, and there's a lot of the money being invested in that. If the governments and the authorities would listen to the educational advice, really what actually takes education forward, we could be a lot further ahead. But I think Bob's done a great job, because I think it actually has raised the profile a lot. And music teachers are saying, much as when I first saw the film, I was horrified. I thought, God, that is me. But people do say to me, that film represents them. And there's so many passionate music teachers who are out there busting their guts out. And some of them are doing it completely under-resourced. If they had more resources, they could do wonderful things, including universities.
So, because I've got a commitment at 7 o'clock and I've got a commitment back with the Olympic Games, I'm going to head off and see. Look, it's been a great night. I'll be very brief because we're right on 7 o'clock and we've had three very impressive presentations and nearly half an hour questions and discussion. So, Look, it was a wonderful documentary, and it's been great to hear Bob Connolly and Sophie Raymond and Karen Carey talk about not only the documentary, but how it was made. Karen talking about the atmosphere and the consequences. And the discussion tonight will be up on our podcast. It'll stay there forever, I guess, or certainly for a long time. And the papers, Bob came along, disciplined with a paper, and with Sophie and Karen, we'll work hard. We'll get a paper. And we had Joel on audio visuals and Anusha on microphone, so it's been a great day. But many thanks to our three speakers for a wonderful experience tonight. Well done. Thank you, Bob.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.